Hello.
Hello.
Oh, so loud.
Yeah. Okay.
It's always so loud every time.
Well, it's life saying, hey, it's loud.
Just getting out there right in your face saying, deal with it, man. I don't
Yes.
know. It's a
Saying,
metaphor or something.
how can I breathe without you? That's what life's doing.
That song is so stupid by itself, let alone being the intro and exit for this movie.
Yes. The number of times that is featured is interesting because you also have Sweet Home Alabama featured an equal number of times. But
Oh, is it in there more than once?
the end credits, where
Oh, well, sure.
and also when all the prisoners are singing it, and then
Yeah, on the airplane.
Steve Buscemi's like, "This is what irony is." Because they all died on a plane.
I thought that was very clever when I was wait, how old was I when this movie? 13. Was a good line, Steve Buscemi.
Oh, and I should reveal this to the audience, since I've revealed it to you. Let them all in on this little factoid. This is the first time I've ever seen this movie. I did not see it. It looked dumb, and I think it was too violent for me, perhaps, or something. I think was the
Oh, you weren't allowed?
I don't think it was the kind of movie my mom would have gone to. So I don't, and we weren't really there for that one. And then for some reason, nobody watched it in college. But this seems like one of the movies that would have slot would have fit in with all of the other choices that the other people around me were watching in college at the time. Your Bad
That's a
Boys
little late. I
2s and
mean, you know,
stuff.
it's, yeah, I mean, once you graduate to Bad Boys 2, there's not really a lot of need to go back to Con Air. It's kind of like an old classic. But it does fit the mold, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like one part Top Gun, one part no, more like half an ounce Top Gun, and then one part Speed and one part Bad Boys 2. I it's a very weird mix of things that are in here.
It's got some serious The Rock vibes as well, I believe.
Yeah, well, Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage, yeah. You know, here's a question that I've been contemplating as I was tweeting about how this movie has extremely Michael Bay energy for not being a Michael Bay movie, which of course we know the reason for that being Jerry Bruckheimer. But it really makes you wonder if was Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay sort of the influence in the late 90s action movies, or was Nicolas Cage sort of like this weird muse for these absurd action movies?
No. I don't
You don't think it was Cage?
No, I don't think I would not attribute anything to him.
That's correlation, not causation. Correlation, not cageation.
that's good. Please write that down. No,
Okay.
he I think he's much more interested in inhabiting the role, really getting into that part that he plays. I don't really think he
You
evaluates
mean
the
the
larger,
accent?
yeah. Whatever he's
He
trying to
signed
do.
up for the accent. He saw Army Ranger from Alabama, and he's like, "Oh boy," rubbing his hands together, like, "This is gonna be something good for me."
Nice juicy role for Nick Cage to disappear into.
Get to grow my hair out, and I get to talk like Forrest Gump.
Man. But this is I don't know. There are a lot of weird choices that are made here, but I think more to your point, the producer Jerry Bruckheimer brought his cocaine energy to this, as he does to many, many things. And there are a lot of action movies that are heavily influenced or almost exclusively produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. He has a sort of dumb alpha, thing that he likes to produce and to showcase to people, and people eat it up. He also likes working with Mark Mancina, which, that gives you some of that same energy every single
Is
time.
Mark Mancini, did he do the score for this? I didn't even look.
Mark Mancina and Trevor Robin, Rabin, Rabane, Rabin, Rabin. You know when
Do
you
you think
say a word and then it loses all meaning, and then you just keep repeating the word? Plan, 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 plan.
It's a good.
It's a reference.
You think Jerry Bruckheimer just has like a playbook? Like, all right, there's got to be at least two fist fights. There's got to be a fast two seater classic car chase. There's got to be just like low angle dolly moves around people as their hair blows in the wind. Like, you think he has like something like that?
I don't think he has a list. I think he keeps it all up here. I say gesturing to my temple. Like he seems like the kind of person that knows it when he sees it and communicates it when he wants it.
If the camera blocking doesn't give him an erection, you got to go back to one.
Yeah, and also you have a need for speed in everything as it propels you from set piece to set piece. He loves big set pieces. And less of a concern in regards to executing geography for understanding scenes and how action is occurring in those scenes. But
I mean, how are you going to have any sort of geography to base your positioning on when the camera is on the ground looking at the sky?
Yeah, and swirling around things and flying by, and then you break the 180, but not on purpose. just because somebody wanted a different shot, I think. But it is, it works in its silly way because it's all just moving by so fast. It becomes just a lot of noise. That sound and fury signifies Boku box office bucks, apparently.
So you're saying you loved it is what you're saying.
I found it to be... I found it to be fascinating, a fascinating artifact. I can appreciate it, you know, the same ways that I can appreciate things like Bad Boys 2 or, you know, the ridiculousness of The Rock, although it's been a really long time since I've seen that. But other Bruckheimer things that he's also done in the 90s, a lot of forgettable stuff, as it turns out. Like, wasn't there one with, like, Anthony Hopkins and Chris Rock and... Chris Rock was like his twin of his dead brother who was an operative and he was being trained. I don't know. Jerry Bruckheimer did a lot of weird things.
Wait. Hang on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Jerry Bruckheimer film you're talking about here?
Produced by. I don't remember who directed that one. I have to say, a lot of times with Jerry Bruckheimer movies, it becomes sort of inconsequential who directed it.
You don't really think of a producer having such stylistic influence over every aspect of it, but he really does put a stamp on things, doesn't he?
He sure does. Here it is. Bad Company, directed by Joel Schumacher, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and Mark Stenson, and
right before Red Dragon.
Yeah, you got Anthony Hopkins, Chris Rock, Gabriel Mock, who I don't remember what he did in this, and Trevor Rabin. Rabin plan.
When an Ivy League educated CIA agent is killed during an operation, the secret agency recruits his twin brother, Chris Rock.
It's a pretty terrible movie.
I feel like we need to watch 2002. this has no marks in its win column so far. Nothing about this could possibly indicate that it would be a successful film. Oh, you got Kerry Washington in here?
Mm-hmm. Dan, you want me to tell you how I know that this was not a successful Jerry Bruckheimer outing?
Did you see it?
Yeah, well, I saw it, but also I don't even need to remember it. I can look at the Wikipedia page, and it had a budget of $70 million, and it had a box office of $66 million.
Nice. When, it's got Gabriel Mocked in it too. He's got fancy hair.
Yeah. When that happens with the Jerry Bruckheimer film, something went real bad, real wrong with it. You got no turnout for that one.
You mean that it's almost like they based a Jerry Bruckheimer action movie on an extremely old Anthony Hopkins? It didn't really work very well.
Well, and
like those Steven Seagal movies in his later years where all the stunt guys are like flipping and he's barely like moving his arms because he doesn't really do that anymore.
I don't think a lot of the action came down to Anthony Hopkins. I think it was mainly about the hilarity of the Chris Rock fish out of water story impersonating his dead brother thing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm keeping Bad Company here on my list of things to see.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry Bruckheimer's just produced a ton of stuff. Coyote Ugly for some reason.
That screws Jerry Bruckheimer, doesn't it?
Flashdance.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Why not?
Kangaroo Jack.
Kangaroo Jack.
That was the one with the CG kangaroo.
Oh, I thought that was like a Crocodile Dundee style thing, not like a buddy cop.
No, I worked on a Jerry Bruckheimer movie.
Was it Kangaroo Jack?
No, it was G-Force. That's the one about the guinea pigs.
That was a Jerry Bruckheimer movie?
Yeah, a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, directed by Hoyt Yateman. So I think that may be the first and only thing he's directed. Yes, it is. Poor guy. Mm. I think he had experience making other things on a number of occasions, and this was his first time in the director's chair, and it didn't work out so well.
Mm. It's going to be a weird question. I feel like we've discussed this before, but it's worth discussing again. What exactly is Jerry Bruckheimer's deal?
I don't know. Again, I just go back to cocaine is my assumption.
He's from Detroit, apparently.
Yeah. He just...
He lived in Arizona at some point.
Yeah. In May 2006, he was honored with a Doctor of Fine Arts degree from the University of Arizona's College of Fine Arts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you say, Tucson.
What an honor.
I shouldn't say that. I know some people that got arts degrees down there.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they found it equally meaningful now that, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer has graced them with his presence.
Ooh, his birth name is Jerome Leon Bruckheimer, and his nickname is apparently Mr. Blockbuster.
Yes. Well, I mean, he's made a lot of blockbusters. I was poking fun by cherry picking a few of the ridiculous things he's made over the years, like The Ref.
I never saw that. I remember seeing that box with Dennis Leary with his leg up on the wall there,
mm-hmm.
at an actual Blockbuster or Hollywood Video. Every single time I went in there for my entire life, it was always there. And I always thought that's probably an interesting movie because Dennis Leary, but I've never seen it.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you maybe the reason why Jerry Bruckheimer was called, Mr. Blockbuster is because of how many movies he had in Blockbusters. And The Ref was always there. I have it on DVD, and I thought...
Do you really?
Yeah, because I thought the movie was very funny, and I can't watch it because it has Kevin Spacey in it. Apparently, the director of photography has, according to news from literally today, he was a registered sex offender. So that was, you know, you don't exactly want to go back and dwell on that one. But the mom from Mary Poppins is in it, so there's that, I guess.
I've never seen Mary Poppins.
You've never seen Mary Poppins?
I've never seen Mary Poppins.
You've never seen Mary Poppins?
I've never seen Mary Poppins. Con Air was my Mary Poppins.
You have never seen Mary Poppins.
No, see? Occasionally, I suggest a movie, and you're like, I've never seen Con Air. It's like, well, we're doing Con Air then, and then it doesn't really come out that I've never seen things like Mary Poppins.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to make us watch Mary Poppins. I don't think that you'll get a lot out of that experience at this point in your life. I think that's kind of something you need to have nostalgia for in order to enjoy as an adult, because it's old and creaky. But I'm just a little surprised. It's just one of those things that like every child has seen. So I don't know what's wrong with you, is I guess what I'm saying.
I was apparently busy being forced to rewatch Blues Brothers for the 800th time instead of watching Mary Poppins.
Fascinating. So any
or Fantasia or something.
Fantasia. We had the tape of Fantasia, and I would just fast forward to the parts that I liked, which was basically Night on Bald Mountain and the one with the Greek mythology stuff, the centaurs and things. It being the tape cassette that was in the 90s, they had omitted apparently the racist stuff that was in that. So that was interesting. Look that up.
All I remember is the giant devil demon thing in that one part.
Yeah, that's Night on Bald Mountain.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the name of the parts. And then obviously the one with all the brooms.
Yes.
That they turned into another Nicolas Cage movie featuring Jay Baruchel. You know, we should do a Cage Miss. We should do a Nick Cage Miss.
No, I think you find that there is another podcast that reviews movies that does that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We should do that, though, because there's a lot of Nicolas Cage movies. You've never seen The Sorcerer's Apprentice, have you?
I know. And No. But Dan, no. We're not doing that. We're not going to fall into that trap.
All right, we'll start with Gone in 60 Seconds, then we'll work our way up. National Treasure is another one that is on our list of Cage movies that you need to see.
Who made this list? Did I make this list?
I think Nicolas Cage made this list for you.
Okay.
Anyway, let's get back to some Con Air. We've got Jerry Bruckheimer. We've got a lot of cocaine energy. We've got an Alabama accent for no reason. How do you like how speedily they got into the introduction of his character here, where he is not retiring. He's being dismissed from the Army Rangers.
Discharged, I think.
Yeah,
is what you would say.
He's heading home to his little town in Alabama to see his wife and would-be child. The locals are none too thrilled with him in his little uniform there.
I hate this opening to this movie a lot. It tries to do this newsreel thing to give it this zeitgeist feeling, kind of like The Hunt for Red October, where, you know, I'm trying to like chime in on some stuff that's happening out in the world. Only with The Hunt for Red October, they're like, hey, we wrote this movie before this happened, so leave us alone. But you know, you have this weird thing going on with that newsreel stuff, and then it's just like with the narration, the voiceover for that, where it's explaining like, oh, Army Rangers, they do this, they never leave a man, blah blah blah. And it's like, okay, well, I guess these are the character traits for Nicolas Cage, is what we're like being fed here. And then
he's a man of honor and dignity and a soldier and a warrior and stuff.
Yeah, and then we go to the Top Gun filter setting, where they just say, hey, just do Top Gun. Just copy what Tony Scott did for like those scenes of romance, or the feeling of being in a bar, and that military thing to tap into. So you kind of have that weird energy from Nicolas Cage in an accent trying to like filter that macho military thing, and you have the romance coming from Potter's her last name, but I don't think I've seen her in anything else.
She's been in things, I can't remember. Yeah. What?
Monica Potter as Trisha, and for some reason people don't like him and are picking a fight with him. And
it's not so much that they don't like him, it's that they do like her, and he's married to her, and now he's back, and they don't like that.
Yeah, but I just, as far as like a reason for this conflict, this is pretty thin.
You know, I mean, drunk guys in a dive bar in Alabama, that's about as much as you really need.
Yeah, only when they have the confrontation in the rainy, muddy parking lot later, and there's three guys, and one of them has a switchblade, it's like, under what circumstances would these interactions have escalated to this point? None. But the movie needs
an hour worth of drinking.
Yeah, well, the movie needs him to kill somebody very fast, somebody of no consequence, but needs to have him do it in such a way that it's self-defense. However, then so that way we are on his side and we don't hate him for murdering the guy. We as the audience are like, oh, well, there's no other way he could have gotten out of this situation other than sticking that guy's, you know, nose in his brain. And that unfortunately gets paired with the really bad scene of him in the courtroom where they're doing the ADR for the judge, and they're like, ah, oh, you're a weapon because you were in the army and you committed manslaughter and you murdered the guy, so you gotta do this thing, and I'm gonna sentence you to 10 years.
We hold you to a higher legal standard than regular citizens, which is not true.
No, none of this is true. None of this would have happened like this. He would have claimed self-defense because there was a guy in the parking lot who had a knife, and I know that another guy picked up the knife in the dark, muddy parking lot somehow and ran off with it, but there is just no way that this would have gone in this direction.
You know what would have really happened is they would have thrown the dead body in a ditch, and then since he knows the guy who runs the bar, he'd be like, well, this never happened.
But so anyway, it's just this ridiculous setup, and they get through it quick only they keep calling back to this because we have these character traits where he's this loyal army ranger who doesn't leave a man behind and does the right thing and won't back down from a fight and will defend himself. And so he can kill somebody if he has to defend himself. And that is what propels you through this movie for everything that happens afterwards. And it's unfortunate because this is just so sloppy. But then we get to the situation of doing the montage of, oh yeah, I've been imprisoned. My hair is getting longer and longer and longer. Now my hair looks ridiculous, but don't worry. You'll only notice it when the wind comes by. And then
I can do so many pull-ups. I can do handstand push-ups. I can do sit-ups. And I don't even care that there's a riot in the prison and then there are flaming mattresses being thrown. I'm just going to sit here and read my book and cover my ears.
Yeah. Remember when he does the legs crossed weird sitting push-up thing where he's like using his core and his arms in order to, like, you know, pull his cross legs above the ground. I don't know what the name of that particular yoga pose is.
Oh, where you're like sitting with your legs crossed and then you push off the ground?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's just doing all this ridiculous stuff.
He's very zen.
Yeah. So he's content.
He's learned to speak Spanish. He's improving himself so he can see his daughter when he gets out of prison.
I really expected the learning to speak Spanish thing to come more into play.
Doesn't he say some things in Spanish, or he listens to somebody say something in Spanish on the plane?
I thought it was John Malkovich who's speaking Spanish and talking Spanish. But maybe I missed something.
I don't know.
I've only seen this movie once, and I doubt that I will hold on to everything that happened in it in my brain.
Well, it's a shame that you didn't get to fully appreciate this movie in the 90s and early 2000s, where you could watch it on repeat on TNT for like 3 weeks straight, and then you could really get it burned into your head.
Something tells me all the quote-unquote good stuff would have been removed from the movie.
The good... Well, you would just be left with, you know, the hair blowing in the wind, and then the accent, and then, you know, explosions and John Cusack.
Yeah. Man, John Cusack.
Do you think they gave him any direction here, or did they just say, be John Cusack?
I think they said, here's a suit that you are going to walk around in like it's a tent, and just be yourself. And
I mean, lest we forget that this is 1997, where clothes were unnecessarily baggy.
Yes, but his is extra baggy. He's like, it's very blousy, I would say, almost.
Yeah, he could probably hide several firearms underneath that suit if he needed to, like, tuck them into place. It's a very, like, conspicuous, like, hello, we are three children standing on each other's shoulders, not John Cusack.
Yeah, it's a little, I don't know, Miami Vice or something. Like, there is a quality to it where it doesn't seem to match wherever he's stationed, which I think is Fresno, supposedly, or something. Or they're leaving from Vacaville Airport, Vacaville, California. I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It does. You know, it's all nondescript, deserty and windy and dusty.
Yeah, and then some overhead shots of downtown Los Angeles for some reason. But they have this strange interaction where we have, you know, kind of like in Hunt for Red October, we have these dueling protagonists who don't share the same screen for much of the movie and are off doing independent stuff. So we have all the Nicolas Cage stuff, which at this point in the film mainly consists of him going, I'm going to see my daughter on the 14th. See my daughter. It's her birthday. I'm going to see my daughter.
Little Casey Poe.
Yeah. And so he's all excited about that. And he's got his flight out of there, and he could just shut up and sit there the whole entire time, but instead he decides to have a conversation with everyone, which is, you know, odd. But he gets onto this plane, and the plane is being overseen by John Cusack's guys, and then Kamini, who I was absolutely surprised about because I think I like blinked or something and missed his title card credit. He shows up, and for some reason, he has what I can only describe as some sort of New York, New Jersey tough guy accent that is going on that does not compute. Because
it feels like he's playing Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah, he is very Irish though.
Yes,
there is really no masking his Irishness in this. I know him primarily as Chief O'Brien from Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and he played that role for many, many years, and he's Irish in that, and that's fortunate because had he been cast in a role where he needed to pretend to be from America, he would have not made it on to so many episodes of that series because he completely fails here. And I don't know what casting circumstances occurred where someone said, you know what, for this guy's part, get me the guy from Star Trek who's Irish. I want that guy.
Well, his character name is Agent Duncan Malloy, so that's kind of an Irish name, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's not playing... he's not pretending to be... an Irishman who is in this setting, who has adopted the role of being a police officer, much as you might find in earlier cop stuff of an earlier era. Instead, he is some tough guy, New Yorker guy, which, again, does not compute. There are scenes where he's just walking in, shouting at people and doing his tough guy thing, and it just doesn't work because you're like... rolling all of your R's and stuff.
He drives a 60s convertible Corvette with license plate as kicker.
Mm. Yeah, and so we quickly determine that he is the tough, you know, slightly incompetent, mostly incompetent guy who's going to be a thorn in the side of our good guy who's good and isn't afraid to bend some rules to get things done.
Do you think his character was written in there almost entirely just because Cusack needed to steal somebody's car and it needed to be a cool car?
I think you needed to have some friction between him and someone else, and his boss could have been that role. However, the boss is not really featured in this film. He makes a couple of decisions, but he mostly is just standing off screen.
Is that the guy with the glasses who stands next to Cusack and just kind of shakes his head a few times?
Yeah. Like he's like, yeah, we need to do this. And Kamini's like, let's blow him out of the sky. And John Cusack's like, no, you can't blow him out of the sky. We got an ally. And the guy's like, no, I don't know about this plan. We're going to go blow it out of the sky. That's what I agree to. And then they leave on their Apaches to go do that. I think they were Apache helicopters, or at least movie versions of Apache helicopters. But they, so they have that friction between them. So that way there's, you know, John Cusack trying to get stuff done in the system and then the system being like, no, you can't do that thing. And so that's the drama for him.
He's a Boy Scout. He's probably out saving the rainforest in his flip flops or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a great line. We have to say there's some very bad writing in this movie, and not just like the absurdity of the plot, because if you watch more than 5 minutes of this movie, you have to accept the plot. Otherwise, you're just going to be miserable the whole time. And it's not much of a plot, but it's there. So that's not what I'm talking about. But there's a lot of dialogue where they're like, we're going to do some cool dialogue right here, and we're going to do some slang, and you're really going to love it. And it's like somebody's uncle wrote it, and it's very stupid.
Yeah, its writing's very bad. You have things like, I said, put the bunny back in the box. And you get
probably
to go with that.
So dramatic on the paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can imagine someone else reading that line, like Bruce Willis or some other action hero, where they would maybe not be as affected in their performance as Nicolas Cage is. But instead, Nicolas Cage is like, I'm going to read it like this. And it's like, why would you do that? It doesn't make any sense.
What if it was Batman? He's like, mm-hmm. Why couldn't you put the bunny back in the box?
What if Batman talked like Nicolas Cage in this movie? Joker, put the Batman back in the box. No.
No, I can't. I'm trying to put those voices to. He was almost Superman. Yeah. Like, we almost had that vision.
Yeah, thanks, Tim Burton.
Didn't he have, he had the long hair too. He had like long black hair.
Mm-hmm. And then a black suit with like a sequined or metallic Superman S on it.
Mm-hmm. On there was glowy stuff planet, too. There was like LEDs. God.
Put the kryptonite back in the lead box.
All right, life is like a box of bunny rabbits.
Anyway, man, I'm just not going to be able to get over this accent. What a choice.
You know, he does a lot of strange accents mm-hmm. over the course of his career, but this one, it might be the least successful. Although, like, what is his normal accent? He has a bit of an accent by default.
He is Nicolas Cage by default. He is a manner of speech. I would not necessarily call it an accent so much as like a pattern, a way of like sort of performing himself that has become exacerbated, I guess, over the years by his being hired to be Nicolas Cage in many roles. So you always just wind up with stuff that is very Nicolas Cage when you get Nicolas Cage these days. But with this stuff in the 80s and 90s, I think he's really sincerely trying to pretend like he is, you know, inhabiting these roles. I mean, you got to look at like his earliest roles, why am I blanking on it? It's one of my favorite movies. Snap out of it. Moonstruck.
Moonstruck.
So he's, you know, it's a different kind of thing. Like, he's doing a different performance in that, but he's trying to be this guy that he's in that, and so he tries to inhabit this role. I think he does that more successfully than he tries to be this Alabama army guy. I think that doesn't work. And I don't think anyone is hiring him to inhabit any roles these days.
Mm. Well, I will give him this. He does have very broad shoulders, so that works for the Army Ranger thing.
Okay. Is that what you look for on your spec sheet for your Army Rangers? Shoulders wide. Check.
It comports with the uniform is the reason.
Yes, yes. You got to fill out the uniform. You don't want to look like John Cusack. But what happened if... So if you put him in a suit in this movie, would he have looked like John Cusack? It just would have been in a ridiculously bigger suit, or would they have put him in a suit that would have fit him, but would be swimming around on John Cusack?
That is a good. Well, I mean, avoiding the fact that Nicolas Cage is the star of this movie, so all of his clothes need to be tailored more appropriately, so he looks more badass when he's fighting and stuff. I think, yeah, they would have put a suit on him that fit everywhere except the arms. The arms look like they would have been taken off of his dad's suit, and they would be, like, covering most of his hands.
I think he would have just ripped the arms off of the suit, probably.
Oh, sure. Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
Part of it would get torn, like around the forearm.
Yeah. Oh, no. Just right at the shoulder.
Oh, okay.
He'd have that sleeveless look. Yeah.
Going like a biker. Well, you know, there's there's an attorney here in the Phoenix / Gilbert region who has billboards where he's wearing a suit with no sleeves. So he can show off his big buff arms and his tattoos.
An attorney, you say?
Yeah, I think he represents motorcycle riders primarily.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I can see why he would want to connect deeply with his customer base.
Yeah. I feel like he's always holding something too, like a big, like a sledgehammer or something at the same time.
Well, yeah, that gives you some way to flex your arm, because otherwise you just got your arms dangling down at the side. You want to have them up, and then you need to flex them, but you don't want to flex empty arms. That just looks ridiculous. So you need a prop in order to have a reason.
I mean, if we've learned anything from Instagram, it's like you've got to stage yourself in such a way that it allows you to flex your best features.
Yeah. And like, there's that one pose you can do where you put like one leg in front of the other leg at a certain point, and then you like, what is it? You stand on the back tiptoe of one leg in order to like flex a calf. Anyway, people are ridiculous is what I'm saying when they're taking their photos. But the movie quickly introduces us to many other actors who you're just like, wow.
Yeah.
You have Rachel Ticotin as the lady on the bus, who is one of the officers, I guess, police enforcement officers or whatever, the jail system officers. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of being a tough cookie in this, for the first part. And then she's a damsel in distress for the rest of the movie. Her biggest role, to my recollection, is Total Recall. So it's kind of disappointing to see her underutilized, I guess.
I mean, she's fairly tough in this movie, but yeah, she's handcuffed to a cage most of the time.
Yeah, I have to say, probably was a terrible day to be on set for her. Just, you're going to be here handcuffed all day. And I'd be like, okay, my arm's asleep. We only have 6 more hours to shoot. But the other cast of characters that you're also introduced to once they start loading them onto the bus, you get a rundown of all of their, like, I guess, evilness or whatever. But
yeah, when they're going down the dossier of bad guys, that's when the writing starts to get really bad. By the way, one notable call out, Angela Featherstone is in this movie, who you may recognize for a number of things. Most people would probably recognize her from The Wedding Singer as the Linda, the woman that leaves Adam Sandler. But she's in here with very short blonde hair, and she was also in Friends. So I guess she was, you know, big in the 90s. But yeah, she's one of those people that's always there, and you're like, I know that lady. What is she from?
Yeah. Ginny. Mm.
Yeah. So what did you think of our titular bad guy of Con Air, John Malkovich?
I found him to be ineffective at being physically menacing. But they tried to make up for it, I think, with his, I guess, pithiness or whatever.
He has some puns, right?
Yeah.
And then he has a gun, he shoots some people. He's I feel like he's got the right attitude and tone. Like he's intimidating. He can play a good bad guy, but you're right. He's not really the kind of guy that you look like you're gonna go up against in a fist fight and you're afraid.
No, but he's, you know, smart. And so he's sort of in this Hans Gruber role for this movie, but he's in my opinion not as good of a character as written and acted as someone like Hans Gruber compared to what John Malkovich is doing in here.
You just really like Hans Gruber suits.
Yes,
it's all about the suits with you, isn't it?
It's way better suits. But you also have I think John Malkovich has a weird I'm trying to think, what's his name, the other actor? He has a Brad Dourif energy, sort of, in this. That's the actor who usually plays, like, serial killers and things. Where Brad he has that sort Dourif. Of, like, nervous, manic, but, like, spring on you kind of thing.
He's more intimidating than Brad Dourif.
Oh, yeah, I would say so. Because I think he's also taller than Brad Dourif. But he's not... So John Malkovich is fine. I don't like Nick Chinland as William Billy Bedlam Bedford.
He's so good. He was absolutely made for this role. Like, this is what his face and his hair and his tone of voice are built for.
Okay. And he just kind of looks like Jeremy Sisto, but worse.
I don't know who that is.
He was in Clueless, and then he went on to be in a lot of other things.
Oh, that guy? Yeah. No. He's like the bad guy version of him, sure. I think Nick Chinlin would have made an amazing bad guy in the Fast and Furious series if he was like 10 years younger.
I guess. So, yeah. But I didn't really love Nick Chinlund. But I mean, also his character is poorly written, so I mainly attribute it to that.
And then you got Ving Rhames up there in the sort of the C-suite of bad guys in this movie.
Yeah, and I have to say I'm a little disappointed because I think that Ving Rhames is much better than this. But I don't know. They just kind of gave him some garbagey dialogue stuff. But at least he's a little sharper than some of the other characters that are in here. So he figures some things out.
He has the meats.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What'd you think of Bubba here being a sidekick again?
Not wild about it.
Sidekick to a dopey dude from Alabama twice. It's
not really like a good trajectory for him, but you know.
He's diabetic though, and that's really his battle in this film.
I have to say that is peculiar to have as a, because when you really think about what's driving everything here, a lot of Nicolas Cage's decisions come down to whether or not he can leave Mike Baby O Odell behind, and he can't because he's diabetic and they don't have any needles for him, and he'll die without his insulin. And so that becomes the reason why he can't do any of the obvious things, and that's a prop that he is used for throughout most of the film. And then towards the end of the film, he limps around a lot and doesn't do anything, but he's fine. I'm glad they didn't kill him. He seemingly made it to the hospital and probably recovered.
He just got progressively sweatier and sweatier throughout the movie.
Yeah, that's no fun. Just before every scene, just gets sprayed down.
Help keep him cool a little bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then you had a sort of lower rung of evil bad guys like Steve Buscemi. As Garland, the Marietta Mangler Green. And I have to say, little disappointed. Kept waiting for Steve Buscemi to do something more in this film. I'm real glad he didn't kill that little girl. That's good, because I didn't want to watch that happen. But at the same time, I couldn't figure out what the movie is trying to say by not having it happen.
He's a psychopath that... what was he saying? Like, murder is a crime of necessity most of the time. So, he's just really trying to find his way in life. Trying to figure himself out. He needs to go eat, pray, love or whatever.
Well, he's got the pray part down. Because he's, at the end of the movie, he's unleashed upon Las Vegas. And
the perfect town for him.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where it's just like, so what is the movie trying to say about this? That he's evil and out on the town and will be killing people, and it's fault of the people in this movie, or like what is the movie saying is what I'm asking.
I will go on a limb and say that this movie is not saying anything at all about anything, really, other than honor and love or whatever. In as much as it motivates Nicolas Cage to get back to see his traumatized daughter, who they brought to an airplane crash scene on the Las Vegas Strip for some reason. Feel like that would be maybe keep them, in the holding area wherever the U.S. Marshals are setting up base instead of like out on the street where an airplane just crashed.
I also have to say that if your movie logic for why they've never seen one another is that he didn't want her to see him in prison and he's excited to finally see her for the first time and wants to make a good impression, the ending of this movie, not a great first impression, in my opinion. Because of the plane wreckage and the blood and the dirt.
The dirty bunny that he has a rub on his shirt and then give to her.
Yeah, like that's going to clean it. And, like he said, he wanted to get a haircut, but he didn't. I think that he should have got a haircut because he looks pretty scary. And so the little girl's a little scared at the end. It's like, yes, it's logical. So I
thought it was more like she didn't want to mess up her nice little dress with a dirty bunny,
I guess. But it just, it's a little silly. It's a little silly. And then you have like this other cast of characters, in terms of the other bad guys, like Dave Chappelle as Joe Pinball Parker, which was an unexpected moment. Again, I must've blinked, when I was watching the credits, he just pops up and you're just like, I'm just like, wait, is that Dave Chappelle? Yeah. And he's not.
Amanda had the same reaction. She's seen this movie a bunch of times. She's like, "Oh, right, Dave Chappelle. Doesn't he? What happens to them in this movie?" I was like, "Well, He dies. He gets stuck in an airplane wheel, and then they throw a very poorly made facsimile of his body out of the airplane, and it lands on a car.
Yes, a car driven by Don S. Davis, who played General Hammond in Stargate SG-1.
Yeah, you said that. I had no idea that that guy in the car was anything beyond an extra with a couple of lines.
Yeah, I mean, he's his character actor. I don't think he was specifically cast. I don't think he because this was 97. I think Stargate SG-1 may have just started or just after this movie. I don't think he was
this
cast.
This was his big break?
Yeah, no, because he did many years of being a character actor and stuff. I don't think that he was cast specifically because of any Stargate affiliation. I think that I'm just noting a fact that listeners will find fun, like you do.
Yeah, I find it very fun.
Yes.
You know, I have to say, in terms of, character actors, like, it is completely unsurprising that Danny Trejo is in this movie, being very Danny Trejo. He finds an excuse to take his shirt off and wave it like a flag to sort of flag down the guys when he's up on top of the tower, of course, to show off his tattoo. But MC Gainey is a dude that pops up from time to time.
Before we go past Danny Trejo, I have to ask you.
Yes.
Is there a Danny Trejo movie where he does not take off his shirt?
There is absolutely no reason for him to not take his shirt off in a movie, so I'm going to say no.
Okay. Just checking.
Why would you hire Danny Trejo if you're not going to let him take his shirt off?
I don't know. I'm curious if there is some sort of anomaly where someone made this casting error where they hired him and they're like, no, shirt's on the whole entire time. You're in this Victorian London era picture. It's nothing but shirts and cravats. Let's go.
He would find a reason. No, but I feel like you don't even have to tell him shirt's on or off. Like at some point in the film, he's going to pick and a shirt's coming off.
Yeah. Oh, do you think it's in his contract? Like, he gets to call it at some point.
It's probably an unwritten rule of his contract that just like, you know, when Danny Trejo's in your movie, he's going to take his shirt off.
Yeah. Do you think he only does it?
Maybe guide him, but he's going
to
pick.
Do you think he only does it when he's like, this is going to be the scene and he gets to pick? And then the
director's... Yeah, I think he's got final cut on when his shirt comes off.
Man, that'd be funny. All these years working with producers and directors and leads up to him just calling the shots on when he takes off his shirt. But you were saying
you've made it. You get to decide when you take a shirt off.
Yeah, you were saying about MC Gainey, who plays
Earl
Swamp Williams.
He is one of those characters that pops up from time to time. You're like, oh, right, that guy. And he fits in this movie so perfectly. He like this movie was written for him, basically.
Yeah, he is. I don't know. He's perfect for this. Apparently,
big tall creep.
Yeah. Apparently, he says on being typecast, he's quoted as saying, "With a face like this, there aren't a lot of lawyers or priest roles coming my way. I've got a face that was meant for a mugshot, and that's what I've been doing the past 30 years. If I play a cop, it's always a racist cop, or a trigger happy cop, or a crooked cop. But by and large, I play cowboys, bikers, and convicts."
That's a good quote. Where did you find that? Is that on IMDb?
Yeah. No, that's on his Wikipedia page. Then on characters he played, he said, "Swamp Thing and Con Air in a movie with so many villains, take a look at my character closely. Not that it supports the weight of a careful examination, and you see I don't really get in anyone's face. I don't really kill anyone. I'm not a really bad guy. I'm just a guy who likes to fly. He made the mistake of landing his plane full of controlled substances in the wrong place and finds himself in the system. In terms of bad guys, though, the character I played in Breakdown was a very bad human being." There's nothing redeeming about that character.
Yeah, I mean, his character, he's if we're going Die Hard and Malkovich is Hans Gruber, he's kind of the Theo character who's drilling through the vault. Like he rigs up the transponder to be put in the other plane. He hot wires the plane, he's flying it. He's not really a violent evil bad guy. He's just like, you know, he's one of the fun guys in the crew. He's very tall and he's got long hair and he's very creepy, but he's just, you know, he's there doing his best.
Yeah,
and he did not deserve that fire hose.
You know, he should have just stopped the car at that point. I don't think he was going to really make it out of that situation. Maybe they would have been lenient with him, you know?
Doubtful.
No. But then you also got the one guy from Hackers is here.
Which guy?
Renly Santiago.
He was in Hackers?
Yes.
Who was he in Hackers?
Oh, right.
He had the hair. Yes, that's right. I did not recognize him.
Yes. He was in Hackers. And he doesn't do much here, but he adds a little, I guess, spice or vibrancy or something of interest to a scene that he's in. But that's
he
not
has
much.
he adds some stereotypical Latin flavor of some sort, because he's sort of the connection to. Now we entirely also glossed over the fact that the plot of this movie is that some like South American drug lord or something is like paying them to all break out and come like work for him.
I wasn't super clear on the working part, mainly that they were either being paid and then this would allow them the opportunity to escape. And that was for the main crew of bad guys, which did not encompass everybody who was on the plane.
Right. But you think it was like a Joker, like a Suicide Squad kind of thing, where they're like, I'm going to unleash chaos on the world because chaos benefits my business model of selling drugs?
No, I think he also like lied to them. So.
Right, of course, yes.
I think the
initial impetus for them all to break out, and you know, for Cyrus to spend a lot of time in the library researching how airplanes work and stuff, and then hiding his books behind his toilet, was apparently at the behest of some sort of South American bad guy.
Yes, and you know, this movie goes out of its way to tell you that Cyrus is really smart at everything, which is interesting because they do things like. There's decoding, using the Last Supper, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, where you cut out the eye holes, and then that lets you slide it over the letter that he got, and that apparently has a secret code in it for the instructions that he was really receiving in the mail. And then one guy opens up that like case and blows up everything, but. Ostensibly, yes, he's being hired to break out this guy, and then he'll also be free, and then stuff. It'll be good for him, therefore good for everyone. He does not seem to respect or care about anybody who's not specifically part of his crew, but is not excited about killing anyone that he doesn't need to, which is good and bad. Because had he just killed everyone, he would have been fine, who wasn't in his crew. But he was in a situation where they needed to get people off the plane, so maybe that's also part of his reluctance initially, because they managed to kill all the people who were actually supposed to be part of the prison transfer. But then afterwards, he kept everybody alive, and I was just like, but why? Like, how are they benefiting your plan at this point?
You know, brothers in arms, they're all criminals. They got to stick together.
I guess.
Until Francisco double-crossed him with the black jet. What did you think of the scene where, obviously, the flicking the cigarette probably wouldn't actually set it on fire, but that explosion was pretty cool where he burned him alive.
Yeah, this movie has explosions. It
has lots of explosions. Yeah. You got slow motion where Nicolas Cage is running and then dives through a window and then the whole building explodes and he rolls into a car.
Yeah. That was kind of ridiculous. You see him hop out of that window, and then the entire side of the building is gone.
It's pretty great.
Yeah. And then the old man is underneath the truck.
Mm-hmm. And you got the shootout in the old airplane boneyard where the cops apparently don't understand what flanking is, and they come right down that center there, and they also apparently don't know what propane smells like.
Yeah, also, I have to question the construction of an airfield that is surrounded by airplane guts, I guess. That doesn't really make any sense. Like, couldn't they have just driven in from the airfield side?
You know, it's like an outdoor art museum and an airfield.
That was an installation piece for the locals?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, again, geography didn't really make much sense, and they even diagram that where they have John Malkovich pointing at stuff and what's that?
Yeah.
That's a rock.
By the way, did you catch that guy's tattoo? I always thought that was good, and I still remember to this day. He's got a dotted line that says "cut here" across his neck.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, that's the guy who asks what the Rock is.
Ah. Do you smell what the Rock is cooking?
Welcome to the Rock.
Mm-hmm. Many
Maybe
90s.
That's why they made the Rock, just so they could make more Rock puns.
Yeah. Again, it's been a long time since I've seen it. I'm sure it's loaded with them. Yeah.
You want to watch The Rock next?
Sure.
Keep going with the Nicolas Cage, Michael Bay energy?
I guess. Or Jerry Bruckheimer energy. Yeah. He produced that one too, right? Yes.
I don't know, but absolutely. There's no way he didn't.
There's just no way. No way.
I will bet all of my money. Con Air, Armageddon. When was The Rock? What year was that?
It was...
Oh, yeah, there it is, 96. 1986. It was the year before. Oh, yeah. I was thinking it was the other way around, so The Rock came first.
Yeah, so 96, The Rock, 97, Con Air, 1998, Armageddon, and Enemy of the State.
Yeah, that's a big year for him right there.
Wow. 2000, Coyote Ugly, Gone in 60 Seconds, and Remember the Titans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 2001, Pearl Harbor, Black Hawk Down.
2002, Bad Company.
You know, they can't all be winners, right?
2003, Bad Boys 2, Kangaroo Jack, Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, and Veronica Guerin.
Wow. In my head, Pirates of the Caribbean did not come out the same year as Bad Boys 2.
No. I thought that there was way more space between those.
Which did you feel like came first?
Bad Boys 2.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So we both have the same misremembered past.
Yeah, yeah. Big time.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we should just do a Jerry Bruckheimer podcast, just like a series of Jerry Bruckheimer movies.
No, because there's some unpalatable stuff in them.
We've already covered a lot of these: the Beverly Hills Cops, the Top Gun. Mm-hmm. We haven't watched Days of Thunder.
We haven't. We talked about it at one point because it was free.
It's Top Gun in a car.
Yeah, that's the summary.
It's just as orange.
I mean, who doesn't love orange? Orange, you glad? They made it.
It's as orange as Jerry Bruckheimer's beard.
Yeah, it's a pretty unnatural color. But the Con Airs, they, you know, gotta land, get the people off that are supposed to be part of the prison transfer, let the people on. Swamp Thing comes on. He pilots the plane. They get off the ground, and now they're scot-free. But this is where John Cusack has been slowly piecing together in his B plot what's going on. Nicolas Cage had planted the tape recorder of the slain DEA agent on the prison guard who was part of the transfer, and he's acting up and gets punched, and that unspools literally the plot. And then he calls in guys, and they have one guy who's supposed to distract them, and John Malkovich shoots him in the head. They hop back on the plane, get out of there, and they don't have the transponder because they had Dave Chappelle take it out there, but then he started hitting on a lady who was working at the airport, and the transponder makes its way onto the Scenic Tours plane, and he makes his way into the landing gear and dies.
Yeah, that sequence, along with a couple of them, there were a few that fall for the sin that we talk about very frequently of things that the audience know are going to happen, and we're just waiting for them to happen and waiting for the people in the movie to realize that they're going to happen. And boy, does it take a long time in this movie sometimes.
Yeah. I think part of the difficulty is we're waiting on John Cusack, who is nowhere near the events of the film. So oftentimes it makes logical sense that he does not have the, of course, access that we have to knowing things, but by the movie's construction, they should be revealing things to us in the audience in a similar way, in a similar time frame as to when they're revealing them to him, so that way you can edit that together faster. You don't need to have them occur chronologically.
Yeah. I think the other thing that got me about the transponder was, like, we see him pull the thing out and then hook the battery up and give it to Chappelle to stick in the other plane. And then you got, what's his name, the guy who double-crosses him, come in and sits in the passenger seat, and he goes, don't they have a way of tracking these planes? And he's like, yes, it's called a transponder. And then they're all like, where's the transponder? And they look at the empty hole, and they're like, LOL. And it's like, we saw that part.
Well,
thank you.
I can't figure out what would have been better. If you had the dramatic tension of them taking off and then realizing that they sent the helicopters after the wrong plane, only after they had gone after the wrong plane, or having the whole thing with Chappelle and then the drama of will he get back onto the plane or not. Because I don't think you could do both, because you wouldn't know why Chappelle had gone off the plane with the transponder if you didn't know he was taking the transponder off. So
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, maybe he would have had to hotwire something else about the plane. But yeah, anyway, there were a couple of those moments. But again, hardly the largest sins of this entire project here.
Yeah, no. You know, this is where John Cusack starts to piece together that the roster of prisoners that are on there, and that there's a ex-Army Ranger, and that he must be an ally that they have on the thing. And Khamenei says that's ridiculous, and that they're all criminals, and that they broke the law, and they're the worst.
Yeah,
et cetera.
Until he finds Dave Chappelle's body with Sharpie on it, and then he's like, "Aha! I knew it. He's my buddy." And they don't shoot each other at the airfield and stuff.
Yeah. And he has the dramatic tension of driving out to that airfield where they're supposed to be making this transaction, because this is the airfield where they were supposed to switch planes, and they were all supposed to go on the other plane. And that's not happening.
It's a little suspicious that Nicolas Cage says he's going to try and help. He's going to go get the fuel truck to refuel the plane since they don't have the backup plane. And then they all just like watch him like going from building to building, like sticking his head in places and like looking kind of suspicious. And he never comes back with the fuel truck. So they were just going to like take off without having refueled.
Yeah. I remember the part where he's standing in the gas station, just drinking whatever it was, or just hanging out before everything starts blowing up. When the plane takes off. So yeah, it was a little weird, because you think people would be like, so why were you standing there specifically not doing anything?
He was at the very least suspicious enough for Cyrus to just shoot him for no reason.
Yeah, I agree. And particularly I think the most suspicious thing is when they find the letter about the release and stuff, and then the guy who has diabetes is like, it's me. He tries to stand up for it, and Nicolas Cage is like, no, don't listen to him. And so he gets shot, and you would have just shot both of them, because it doesn't matter. You don't need to keep them both for any reason.
Also, what did he think he was doing when he was like standing up and like trying to provoke Cyrus, who was literally holding a gun, like saying, who did this? Do you think he's gonna be like, "Wow, I respect you for trying to double cross me. You're on the crew now."
That's what I like about you. You're a go getter. I don't. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? No, I don't think that he would have really appreciated that, as evidenced by him shooting and harming people. But I think it's just one of those things that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense if you are trying to analyze the character of Cyrus. You're just like, you are not somebody who is afraid of killing people, so why wouldn't you kill both of these troublemakers? Because they're both causing you a problem. Yeah,
it's the criminal code. Like, you don't you don't go after certain bad guys. I don't know. There's no reason whatsoever. But yeah, so after there's a lot of antics, and then airplane things, the airplane crashes into Las Vegas, because of course it does. And takes out the Hard Rock Hotel's guitar.
Well, you're missing the drama of whether or not they shoot down the plane.
Yeah, that was a couple of minutes where they're like, don't shoot it down, shoot it down, don't shoot it down. I'm going to block you from shooting it down. Don't shoot it down. And they're like, all right, don't shoot it down. Also, hold fire sounds a lot like fire, so maybe they should come up with an alternate term to yell over the microphones at each other.
Yeah, could you imagine if the radio cut out just at the wrong moment? Fire! Fire!
I said fire. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. So they decide that it's not worth killing all these bad guys just so they can save Nicolas Cage, because he's an ally. He's a good guy. So instead, they crash an airplane into Las Vegas, and surely nobody was harmed in that incident at all.
I think they did more damage to Las Vegas in this than they did in Honey, It Blew Up the Kid.
You know what? I think you're probably right. But it's okay. Las Vegas can rebuild. They have the resources.
When you watch that scene, fortunately, John Cusack at the end of it, when he's talking to Khamenei, he says, you know, I should have just blew up the plane over the desert.
Yeah. Then he says something like, oh yeah, this turned out much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least he apologizes for wrecking his car, which, by the way, what did you think of the, not only did he steal the jerk guy's car, but the jerk guy got, doubly screwed over because the rope that he tied to the back of the plane, to try and slow it down to a piece of concrete, ended up whipping around and catching the axle of the Corvette and, picking it up as it flew away and it was dragging a Corvette behind it.
I thought that that was very coincidental, for the dramatic purposes of this movie, but you know, it's that kind of a movie and that it lands so you can look at the license plate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He got what he deserved for being a jerk.
Yep. Yep. But I mean, the government's just going to pay for his car, so it'll be fine.
If we learned anything from Bad Boys, it's that, they don't reimburse for private vehicles. That's why they drive cop cars.
Yeah, but he didn't drive this into a crime scene. Another agent stole the car and presumably stole this car. He did not have the authorization to drive as Kicker.
Well, and, that, you know, that would go through his regular vehicle insurance, I think.
Oh, okay.
Does Progressive cover car accidents by way of airplanes?
Man, and could you imagine filing that claim? Towers? I feel like that should be one of those farmers insurance ones.
We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
Yeah.
And then come out of there. Well, explain what happened here. Well, you know, an airplane took off and it had a rope attached to the back of it, as you do sometimes. And it caught the car and then dragged it up in the air and took off. And then it ran into the control tower and the rope broke. And well, here we are.
I think they should do a new version of those ad spots with J.K. Simmons where he just talks about car crashes that happen in movies.
That would be a pretty good promo or sort of like cross-marketing thing.
Yeah. Well, don't sleep on that idea, Hollywood. But the, you know, so they destroy basically the strip. But it's not over yet because they have to have more fighting.
Yeah, there has to be a car chase. They get out of the plane, which crashes directly into the front of the casino, which, you know, and then a slot machine 777 and dumps a bunch of coins in the ground back when coins were still a thing. But yeah, they escape on a fire truck, which there were motorcycles there. I don't know why they picked the fire truck, but yeah, they steal a fire truck and then Nicolas Cage and John Cusack pursue on cop bikes along with two other cops.
Can you think of a more conspicuous thing to steal than a fire truck engine?
I mean, I guess you kind of get away with driving really fast with the siren on and people like going like, oh, I better get out of the way. They probably have somewhere important to go. But I feel like at that point you would want to be less conspicuous. So I would like, you know, steal a taxi cab or whatever and then just drive real slow because there are a lot of those around there.
Yeah. Or here's another idea. Just going to throw this one out there. Walk away from the crime scene.
Into a casino?
Yes. Well, like Steve Buscemi does.
Well, he probably didn't have the as many cameras in the 90s.
Yeah. Because Steve Buscemi disappears into the crowd.
Well, he's got that nice white outfit on there. He blends in with the crowd pretty well.
Yes. There's one thing we know about Steve Buscemi. He blends in.
I mean, from a distance. Don't get close to him.
Are huffing and puffing and stuff on the fire truck. They chase after him in the motorcycles. And it's all ridiculous because by this point, Nicolas Cage's family is there. Literally, he sees them deposited from a helicopter. And he's like, nope. You know, they pulled me back in. I got to go do this by my honor code or whatever. And so he hops on the motorcycle along with Cusack. And it's like, Why would you do that? Because there are qualified police officers who rode those motorcycles here.
Well, they follow along too, but they immediately get blasted with fire hoses because apparently they're not as good as riding as an Army Ranger and a U.S. Marshal.
Yes, yes, yeah. Mm. And then you have the other cops who drop their one bite eaten donut and chase off after them too, and they have little success. But John Cusack manages to like break into the cabin and fill it full with water. John Malkovich and Nicolas Cage keep fighting on top, and then there's the ladder, and he
does some pull-ups.
He's
got that big I Am Ahab spear, and he breaks it in half and jams it through his leg, and then Malkovich is like, ah, I'm bleeding everywhere, and you basically cut my leg in half, and I'm just going to pull this wood back out, and then I'm going to attack you again.
And then the most Looney Tunes series of events occurs.
He handcuffs him to the ladder and then raises it while driving, and then there's like an overpass, like a walking path. Yeah, it's like glass or whatever. That you think he's just gonna smash into and just like become pulp, but no, he goes flying off of the ladder through the glass, out the other side of the glass, through some electrical wires which spark, which you're like, oh, did he get electrocuted? No, he didn't get electrocuted, or maybe he got a little electrocuted.
Well,
but no.
And the Foley they use for that is electrocution chair Foley.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
But then he lands on, because, you know, Las Vegas is constantly under construction. Everything's under construction. He lands on a gravel conveyor belt, which takes him, you know, he's like kind of unconscious from the electrocution. It took a lot out of him. He goes up the top of the conveyor belt, then falls down underneath one of those, like, comical, like, oil derrick style, like, 1960s just heavy weights that gets lifted straight up and then drops back down.
I believe it's a pile driver.
Is that a pile driver? It's from a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Yeah, is what it is.
Like and the fact that he comes back into consciousness just as he realizes his head, which fits perfectly inside of this machine, is there, and his skull gets crushed by it. It's just like, what?
Thwarted by his gravel sized head.
Man. Talk about The Rock, huh? The Rock would be his head.
The Rock would be. Yes.
Yeah. But I don't understand, because this movie starts off with the casual murder in self-defense was bad, and that he is a weapon that is dangerous and needs to be punished. And then he kills 3 people in this movie by his own hands. I'm going to count what happens to John Malkovich is killing him by his own hands, regardless of the bananas circumstances that he went through. Nobody went to check and make sure he was okay. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, I think what the lesson here is that, Nicolas Cage never should have been discharged because he's too lethal of a weapon, and they just need to, find an outlet for him to kill people for good.
Yes, which is why they made the sequel to this movie, where he's a vigilante, like Cobra.
You mean the one where his head catches on fire?
Oh, right. The 2 Ghost Rider movies. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't mean those. But yes. You're right that the movie, when I say what is the movie trying to say, and you say that the movie is not trying to say anything, you are right. But at the same time, I keep coming back to that, where I'm just like, you could have said something. This could have been about a thing happening, or there could have been reasons why people were doing stuff. But the movie's like, no, he just he murdered bad guys because they were bad. And then girl a bunny because she's good.
Yeah. If it's saying anything, it's that be loyal to your friends, you're going to have to go through some hell. But on the other end, you'll be able to be with your wife and daughter that you've never met before, because, you know, stay strong or whatever. Yeah. It was a wild ride, though. Did you enjoy the ride?
Yeah. I mean,
in an extremely late 90s fashion.
Yeah, I was along for this ride. At no point did I stop to ask how much of this movie was left.
That's a good sign, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
Bruckheimer keeps you in the game.
It's one of those things where it's just like, I think he knows how to fill a viewer's attention. With what, you know, question mark? But like,
sometimes it's a low angle dolly circle. Sometimes it's some smoke flying through somebody's hair. Sometimes it's a fire truck or a motorcycle that explodes for no reason.
Yeah. And like I said, I was ascribing a lot of the style of this movie, such as it is, to Bruckheimer.
I guess we've kind of not mentioned the director.
A little rude, I guess, but it's directed by Simon West, who I'm not that familiar with. He's English. He did this. I think it was his first. Yeah, it was his first movie. Then after this, he did General's Daughter. And he was an executive producer on Black Hawk Down, which is interesting, I guess. But then he did the first Lara Croft Tomb Raider movie. When a Stranger Calls, The Mechanic, Expendables 2, Stolen, Wild Card, and Stratton, Gunshy, Skyfire, and The Legend Hunters, which he co-directed with Li Yifan. And I think, what is it? Skyfire and The Legend Hunters, I think, are Chinese films. Mm. So
those sound like the names of movies.
Yeah, he's just doing some weird stuff these days, I guess.
Well, you know, I'm glad he's employed. I'm glad he's having some fun doing some things.
Oh, yeah. He directed one episode of Human Target. Remember that show?
I do not. What is that?
Human Target was a quasi-procedural show that I think was based on a graphic novel or a comic book. Yeah, comic book. Mm.
Did you say The Expendables 2? Because that makes sense.
Oh, he did that one. But specifically, Human Target was a show on Fox, and it had starred Mark Valley and Jackie Earle Haley and Chi McBride.
Why was this guy? I think I maybe saw some promos for this, but
I'm sure you did.
This, just from the IMDb photos, looks more like a parody of a CSI style movie.
It basically is. If you watch it, it's very CSI-esque in what it's doing. But the he only directed one episode of it. For I don't know why reasons. He owed someone a favor, I guess, but but yeah, he did The Expendables too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, Con Air. So this is gonna go into the pantheon of '90s action movies with your speeds and your things, right? You're gonna revisit this from time to time. You're gonna be like, God, remember that time Nicolas Cage on the airplane with the hair?
I may never watch this movie again.
You're lying. I know when you say that sometimes, and you totally mean it, but you're lying.
I mean, I will not seek out watching this movie again. If it is ambient,
I don't think I've ever seek this movie out. I think this is the first time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I don't have a television that's blaring with like movie channels on all the time like you do. So I don't like walk into a room and it's like halfway through Con Air and sit there watch the rest of Con Air. I'm sure if I did that I may do that, but
you should rectify the situation. Gotta get you some TBS and some TNT up in there.
Yeah, that's what I need. It's just gonna walk into a room and be like, oh well, Tin Cup's on again, time for me to sit here and watch Tin Cup.
These days I feel like that's on one of those obscure, like, used to be Paramount but is something else channel now.
Well, it's still the Paramount channel.
I know, but there's a bunch of those that like change into something else. It's like a random Universal channel, or like it's the Golf channel. I think it's probably just on the Golf channel now.
Because it was, what was it? It was like Spike TV to Esquire TV to Paramount TV, I think was the trajectory that it went on.
Then you had you got FX, and then FXX, and then there's something else in there.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Cable channels are confusing.
And stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Con Air's good.
It's fine.
You loved it.
To steal something from another podcast. It is a good bad movie. Is what I will say about it. It is
two thumbs up.
No. How dare you, sir?
Okay, two. I don't know. Half thumbs up.
Two waffling hands.
That's the description of this show.
Yeah. Two flaccid waffling hands. But on that note, I think we're done with this. It's time to play some Leanne Rimes or Sweet Home Alabama and get ourselves out of here.
I do like Sweet Home Alabama.
Sweet Home Alabama. Do 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 do. What's the song about?
Well,
it's not like some Confederate stuff, is it?
Probably.
Oh.
I think there's at least a couple of mentions of things in that song that are, you know, not the great. Like, you know, the Watergate doesn't bother me. Does your conscience bother you? It's like, well, are you sure?
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. That sounds like something. I bet this was a big hit at like certain presidential rallies held by one notorious former president. Well, still president. Counting down the days. Well,
speaking of a movie that plays Sweet Home Alabama that we should definitely do on this podcast, have you ever seen the movie Sweet Home Alabama?
I'm trying to remember. That's the one with Reese Witherspoon where she goes back home and Candace Bergen is maybe going to be her mother-in-law but isn't, and Josh Lucas makes lightning sand art.
Wow, yeah, you nailed it.
And she's contemptuous of him, but then falls back in love with him and realizes that she loves him. And then
Patrick Dempsey.
And the New York guy, you know, he's sad, but he takes it really well. And Candace Bergen's very upset about it.
So you have seen this movie.
I've seen at least that part of it because my mom has watched
that. Has TBS or TNT?
No, I don't even remember what it was on. It may have been Bravo or something, but she watches stuff like that, so I have seen
Ethan Embry's in there.
Struggling to remember who that is. Oh, right. The Empire Records guy.
Can't hardly wait. I thought is he in Empire Records also?
I thought he was.
Don't remember. I thought
he was the one.
Yeah, he's in Empire Records.
He eats the pot brownie and then hallucinates the guar thing.
You know, I know we watched Empire Records, but I don't remember any of it.
That's okay. That's one for me to remember and for you to forget. And this is one for you to remember and for me to forget.
Okay. Now you can cue the Skinnerd.
Sure. Or the Leanne Rimes. You never know.
Or both at the same time.
Oh, let's not.
It was a great mashup.